Namaskar. My name is Avadhutaka Ananda Deva Priyacharya.
So tell us how you got involved with Ananda Marga initiation. What brought you to the spiritual path?
I was in my early 20s and I was searching for something. I was searching for the direction in my life. And in particular, I was torn between whether I should dedicate some significant time to a volunteer project like Peace Corps abroad, or if I should find an ashram and really create a solid foundation for spiritual practice. But I didn't yet have a specific spiritual practice, so first step was to, you know, figure out which spiritual path was the right one for me. And I began a search that took me to Chicago. And I was just randomly like following my heart and going to different groups where I felt some kind of resonance. And I kept asking this question, you know, how to know which is the right path? And I got some very cryptic but very deep sort of spiritual answers about first you should know yourself or things like this. And it didn't satisfy me. At one point, I simply got overwhelmed by too many choices. And so I sat down one morning before going to work, and I was writing a long letter to one of the gurus. And essentially, I was just describing this problem, which way to go. I wrote and I wrote, and at one point I realized, you know, nobody can answer this question for me. She can't answer this question for me. So I simply closed my eyes and I asked internally. I'm like, okay, I don't know exactly how to address you, but I know somebody's listening. So please just show me the right way and make it really, really clear. Like, shine a spotlight on the path. No more subtle hints. I need to know exactly the right way to go. It was literally only hours after that, because this was morning, and it was later that afternoon. I was working at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago, and posted on the elevator door when I was leaving my shift was a small Xerox poster, and it simply said, self-realization and service to all, selfless service to all. It immediately struck my heart. It immediately resonated with me that these were the two things that I was seeking to combine. And I had been approaching it as either or. I'm going to either have to go in this direction or I'm going to have to go in this direction. And here, they were combined. And so already from that moment, I felt some excitement. And I went to, the conference had already started 10 minutes before. So I hurried to the room. I was expecting to find a big gathering, but it was small. There was just one Dada and a few people, and he was playing guitar. And at first I thought I must be in the wrong room. I felt like I was disturbing, you know, some small private kind of meeting. And they're like, no, 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 come. They were very welcoming. And somehow everything that he said that night was just like a breeze blowing away all the clouds of doubt and confusion in my mind. Everything was answering my questions. And my reaction was like, wow, so is there a place where you can go and volunteer? And his answer was, maybe you should learn meditation first. Okay, can you teach me? No, you have to learn from a Didi. Where's a Didi? So there wasn't a Didi in my town. And I understood I should come to a big retreat center, and there I could learn meditation. But that was a couple months away. So I felt, looking back on it, that I was really a ripe fruit, because when I found it, it just immediately I started to dive in. I got initiation at a New Year's retreat, and after that, I had an inner desire, like, I always want to be starting my new year like this, with kirtan.
What year was this?
1995. Yeah, so in 1995, I was initiated, and by June, I had decided I'd already decided then, but it took until June that there was a training for full-time volunteers, LFTs. So I went to the LFT training. I sold all my worldly possessions, basically. I cut my hair. Really, later I realized I actually didn't need to do that, but I was just diving right in. And I went and I worked for 2 years alongside my Didi, who was from Romania. And it was mostly because I wanted to learn all of my lessons of meditation as soon as possible. So I thought, I will just sit with her. I will stay with her until she finishes teaching me. So it took a couple years, and I was very fulfilled working full-time. In fact, it was hard to imagine, as 2 years was closing, it was hard to imagine going back to anything else. So that, for me, people ask, like, how did you become an acharya? How did you decide to become a yogic nun? It certainly wasn't on the list of available options that I had in my mind when I was completing university, for example. But when I encountered this, it felt like, looking back, I'd always felt I had too many interests, I had too many things I wanted to do, and I didn't know how to choose. And that was actually kind of an obstacle for figuring out a career. But once I'd found this path, I felt as if my whole life had been preparing me for this role, and that everything kind of fit together. So it was just that sense of rightness that really called me.
And when did you, and why, how did you decide to go to the training, and when?
As I said, it was a gradual kind of decision. I had been working already for more than a year, and I started to think in this direction. And I'd made my decision, but I was hesitating how to break it to my family. Finally, I went back to see them, because I thought I should tell them face to face. And when I tell my mother and father, they're like, oh yeah, but we already knew that a year ago. So I thought, I'm breaking them this big news, but they were already prepared for it. They'd sort of seen the signs. So yeah, for other people, I think it was maybe more apparent that I was going to end up in this direction. Inside, I think, I remember even a few days after I was initiated, I met Dada Dharma Vedananda, and he'd written this book, which I had just begun reading, which is fantastic, really inspiring. And it was exactly those types of stories that made me feel, I want to have a life like that, of adventure, of living completely for God, you know, just trusting, jumping and trusting the net will appear. He had so many experiences of grace and miracles. And I remember asking him what I should do. And he said, well, you should go and be LFT and see if you can adjust with the lifestyle. And if you can, you should become Didi. A few years ago, I saw him again. And I reminded him that he'd said this. And he said, he was laughing. And he said, and what did you think when I said that? And I said, well, I thought it was a very good idea, and that's exactly what I did. So in the end, it was exactly what I did. I went, I lived with the Didis. I really enjoyed it. I really loved it. I loved the feeling of all my energy going in one direction, because during the brief period that I was working in society after university, I felt like that was an obligation that I had to do to survive. And then everything that I really wanted to do, I had to do in my free time. But when I started working full-time in Ananda Marga, I felt, you know, I get to do what I really want to do and what I really love to do all the time. And because of that, I didn't even really feel the need for vacation, because I get to do things like go on retreats. And yeah, I have to do a type of work, but it's also, I get a type of inspiration. So no regrets.
So you went for training. Where did you do your training, and what was it like? What was the experience like?
I went for training in Sweden, and I was there for 2 years. The first part of our training, we had the blessing to be under the guidance of Dada Dhruvananda, who was a very elevated soul. And he had a way, It was nothing like what my Western mind would have been prepared for thinking of a training. Because you think about classes on subjects and kind of organized. Instead, we would go and sit with him, and he would begin in one direction and he would meander all over the universe with different stories. But somehow he would manage to touch points that each of us needed to hear. So something was speaking to each of us, to the situation, the doubts, the problems that we were facing in that moment. It was really kind of mystical how he could do that. And the training is I've now come to realize training is really a Gurukul experience. You're living with an elevated person, and much of the training is not content, it is lifestyle. So you are learning to just be in a spiritual routine and flow and adjust with other human beings. And actually, it's the adjusting with the other human beings where a lot of the developing and sanding of the personality is happening. Because inevitably, when you're with other people, there's gonna be frictions, and that's where your ego comes out. And it's that process that's really the pressure cooker of the training center. It's not the content so much, it's the lifestyle. And it's being in the routine with the strict flow of asanas, meditation, etc. So very powerful experience. At the time, you don't feel like it's so special. You take it for granted that it's normal to do that much meditation and yoga practices. But as you get into the field, you really have some nostalgia. Every acharya has some nostalgia for the training center period.
So how many hours of sadhana would you be doing in the training center?
I seem to remember having calculated at one point, and it was at least 8 hours of spiritual practices. That includes also the asanas and maybe the reading or talk that we would do as part of Dhammacakka. Yeah, so like a full-time job. What other people would consider a full-time job of 8 hours, that was our full-time job.
And since becoming an acharya, what is your relationship with Baba Vema? How has it developed?
So my relationship with Baba is very internal because I didn't have a physical opportunity to meet him while he was alive. So for me, always the biggest source of my inspiration has been directly through sadhana, kirtan, maybe even more kirtan than sadhana most of the time, because that's just where the heart really opens, and where I can really feel some kind of blissful, joyful feeling. And also through trying to deeply contemplate and capture the essence of his teachings by reading and reflecting on them. So I'm particularly drawn to neo-humanism and to the more social justice expressions of his philosophy. That's what I find to be so unique about this path, is there's many spiritual paths, there's many people who are highly elevated, but many are very internal and withdrawn from society. What I really loved about Ananda Marga, because I was an activist of sorts before I came in, was the combination of an active engagement with society. Not just passively, okay, we'll create some nice vibrations and hope everything works itself out, but actually thinking strategically and working to create greater understanding across boundaries, to embrace diversity, to really take a different type of responsibility towards nature, not as just something we act upon, but something that we are embedded within and part of. So for me, doing the work itself, listening within and feeling certain inspirations, certain callings in different moments to do a type of project, that's where I really feel the grace coming, because when I listen to that and I take a step, then often more come towards me. In fact, that leads me to share what I think is one of my most significant encounters with Guru on an internal level through a dream. So I have had a few dreams, but this one really stands out. I was in training center already for more than a year, and before I went, I was really longing and hoping for a sign, some sign that I'd taken the right direction, that this was not only coming from my intellect, but it was received also from Baba. And I had a dream. Up until then, my dreams with the guru were distant, like he was, you know, in a DMC and on a pandal, distant. Or I was sitting alongside of him, but not looking straight at him, or behind. But in this dream, for the first time, he was standing in front of me and he had his arms open. And he said, "I hear you want to become my Didi." And I said, "Yes, Baba." And I ran and I embraced him. And he gave me such a loving embrace. I think in that moment, I sort of dissolved. You know, I lost myself in a blissful state in the dream. And then we sat down and he began to say, "I've been waiting for someone just like you." And he starts to tell me what he wants me to do. You know, he's giving me a list of things that I will do and that he wants me to do. And as he's speaking, I'm thinking, yes, I was thinking of that. Yeah, I had that inspiration. And then I realized, yes, of course, because the inspiration's coming from him. That's what I actually realized when I woke up. Because as I woke up, it started to dissolve. The dream just started to dissolve. I realized I'd had a dream with him. I was still in this very blissful mood. And I realized I had a dream with him, and I start to try and grasp it and remember it, and it's slipping through my fingers. It's just dissolving. I can't remember the details. I can only remember the part that I told you, but I couldn't remember the details of what he was telling me that he wanted me to do. There was only a trace of a feeling that the last part of it was something to do with India. But other than that, I couldn't remember the rest. And what I did remember was that everything he said resonated inside. It was something I'd already felt was important to do. So it tuned me into a level of my intuition that when I have certain inspirations to do something, which isn't for myself, it's something noble, no, something for society, something that would benefit many people, that's the way he speaks to me. That's his guidance from inside. That's him telling me what to do. So I listen to that. And when I do, magic happens.
And one of those magic happenings is in Romania.
Well, for example, when the war broke out with Ukraine, I didn't know what to do. I had so many projects. My hands were full. I had 9 projects going on. And yet I felt this is at our doorstep. This is at the border. There were thousands of people, 10,000 people, I think, coming across the border in the first days, every day. And I'm part of Amortel Romania, so actually the humanitarian branch of Anandamarga. So I was like, we have to do something. And I'm part of a child protection network. They were having an emergency meeting, and I said to them, you know, I had had experience with refugees because I had volunteered also in Lebanon for about 8 years on and off, coming and going to do some trainings and support the staff there. I said, well, we're a child protection network. We should focus on the needs of children because everyone's going to be trying to give out food. And they, a day later, they're like, can you represent the network on television? They're asking for an interview. I'm like, okay. So I represented on a talk show what we as a network would do. We would do things to help children, and how do you do that? And one of my colleagues that I had given training to more than 10 years earlier in rapid response training, you know, for being ready to respond for a humanitarian crisis, she happened to be in Romania. Since I'd last seen her, she'd specialized in emergency psychology. Her name's Melinda. Melinda calls me and she's like, so are you going to go? Are you going to do something? I saw you on television. I'm like, yes, but I don't know what we're going to do. And I called to my good friend that I know from Lebanon, my mentor, Dada, who's an expert in disaster relief management, Dada Winmantrananda. And I asked him if he could come and help me to do an assessment because I have no idea how we should focus and what we should do. And he said, sure. I organized the ticket for him. The next day he was on the way already. And he and Melinda went to the border while I had to go for another project in Italy. And by the time I came back, we already had exactly what we were going to do set. Melinda knew exactly what she needed to do. It was an uncovered need to fulfill the mental health and psychological needs, you know, emergency psychology right at the border. And Dada found his niche with his IT skills and his disaster relief coordination, and he started to coordinate the response, help all the all of the organizations to work better as a team, and to support the government. So it was super exciting. It felt really right. And support came in. We funded ourselves on crowdfunding for the first month. And then because of the positioning Dada had done, we were able to, we had many funders trying to approach us and to help us. And we were able to do some big projects after that. We helped, just now we've wrapped up the projects with refugees. And we helped with our mental health support project, we helped more than 7,000. And with the other projects, 2,000 something, so close to 10,000 people that we did direct services through our team. And that was just from that urge, that feeling inside that I should do something. I don't know what, I don't know how. You know, it looked impossible because I'm one person and I already had my hands full. So he really helps. Like when you have that willingness to listen and to do, then the grace comes. I also am currently in the midst of experiencing the same kind of calling. I have an inner urge, an inner calling, that there's really a need to support directly in Ukraine the educational system. There's so many children that are living under a constant state of tension, underlying tension that affects them, especially when closer to the areas where there's bombing happening. So we already began a collaboration with training some teacher trainers to do trauma-sensitive work with just simple things like deep breathing and also story work, because I feel there's a big power in metaphor. And one of the things that happens during a traumatizing situation is that your sense of the goodness, fairness, and rightness of the world get upside down. And you don't know anymore how to make sense of things, what to trust. And so the human beings can go into a depression. We need hope. We need a sense of meaning and purpose. And so taking a journey, because trauma is characterized by feeling powerless, but when you can work through metaphor at creating a heroic journey that parallels the experience that the person is facing, it can help them to find new inspiration, new hope, and new meaning. We did some story writing workshops where refugees wrote therapeutic metaphoric stories, and we have gotten feedback from our psychologists that, you know, children ask to hear them again and again and again. And that's what I wanted to hear. Even if for one child it is meaningful, it's something that can stay with you your whole life. A good story can stay with you your whole life. So we want to do some immediate types of helping people to be able to better cope, but also some of that deeper work of reconstructing a sense of mission, purpose, meaning to life. So I hope, I don't have any funding. All the funding is withdrawn. I don't know how it will happen, but I feel when I get this type of urge, then usually grace is on the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, David.
No, thank you so much. Namaskar.